Well, we deal with lots of mysteries here on Coast to Coast AM. And for the next couple hours, we'll be talking about ancient aliens and secret societies put together by none other than Mike Barra. We'll be back in a moment with Mike on Coast to Coast AM. Well, let's tell you a little bit about Michael Barra. Mike Barra is an author. He's a lecturer. He's a television personality. He is a self-described born-again conspiracy theorist. He began his writing career after spending more than 25 years as an engineering designer for a major aerospace company, several companies, where he was a card-carrying member of the military-industrial complex. Is he what Eisenhower warned us about? Mike has made numerous public appearances. I've run into him at all kinds of events. He's a great speaker. NASA, physics, UFO conferences. Mike has appeared on NBC, Universal, Sci-Fi Network. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. If I had drummers, Mike, they'd be beating them right now.
Oh, yeah. Good to have. Well, and, you know, I mean, it's great that I appeared on Sci-Fi, which is a network that just brought us Sharknado 3 tonight, which that was my show prep for tonight with Sharknado 3. So
I love it. Was the last time I saw you was the Contact in the Desert?
Yeah.
That was a great time.
It was a great time. It was.
You were swamped with people.
Yeah, well, it was. And, you know, the thing about those shows is that they're they're really spectacular in terms of the number of people that they get in there, given the conditions, given how hot it is. And, you know, it all has to do with the lineup of speakers that you have. You've got guys like, you know, you obviously, and Eric Von Daniken, and it's just been a great event. I'm going back next year, and I really can't wait because it's been my favorite event for a couple years now. And just, you know, the energy there is different than it is anywhere else. Maybe it has to do with the fact the Integratron is nearby.
Mm-hmm,
maybe
there
really
be.
Are energy fields in that area. I don't know, but it really has been. It's just kind of rocketed to the top of the list of conferences just immediately.
Oh my gosh, they sure do. And our dear friend Jimmy Church thinks the world of you, Mike.
Well, I know Jimmy's a great guy, and he graciously allowed me to come on tonight and actually promo this show on his show, which was
did he? Good
yeah,
for him.
Yeah, really, really cool. So you should give him some props for that.
We will do that.
I know he's listening. I think he's had a few vodkas by now, though. So, he has. Let me tell you, he has the best vodka I've ever drank. Not that I've ever drank with Jimmy Church, but you know.
He's been trying to get me to come over his house, you know, because we're both in the L.A. area when I'm here. But he always calls me 10 minutes after I get off a plane somewhere. And he goes, you know, where are you? Come on by. We're having this party. Hey, give me a day's notice or something.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of my problem, too. I mean, I'm telling people, don't you realize how busy I am? I got so many things to do. Plus, you know, now that I'm back in the L.A. area, there's just, again, there's so many fun things to do that you kind of got to schedule your weekends weeks in advance, right?
Yeah, indeed. Mike, lots to talk with you about tonight, including, of course, your new work, Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies. But have you been looking at these pictures from New Horizons on Pluto?
Oh, yeah, of course. They're spectacular and exciting. And you know, the thing about them that's so interesting to me is that, once again, we continue to find out just how wrong NASA is about everything. You know, they can't get anything right, because I think their models of the solar system and how it was created are all messed up. And, you know, Pluto to me is just another example of it, because for years, decades, they told us it was an ice ball and probably covered with snow and ice. And they really didn't find much of anything to that effect. You know, they found these mountains. They tried to say that these mountains were probably made of ice, but they have absolutely no basis for that statement. And, you know, you look at the pictures and they look just like regular old Rocky Mountains to me. So then the question is, you know, what are they going to find as the spacecraft continues its mission and goes out into what's supposed to be the Kuiper Belt? What if they get out there and they don't find any of the snowy objects
mm-hmm.
that they're supposed to find, you know, which I think is probably what's going to happen. When does the point get reached? When do you reach critical mass to the point that NASA has to finally say, you know, maybe our models of this whole solar system really aren't correct. Maybe how we think planets formed isn't the way they formed. And that to me is what's really exciting about it, because it kind of reinforces stances I've taken in books over the years. So I like that. I like NASA, you know, giving me credibility when I don't even ask for it.
Well, you know, and Pluto has five little moons around it. I mean, to me, it's a little planetary system. It's not a planetoid. It's a planet.
Yeah, and really, you know, it is a planet. And Charon, which is the biggest of the moons, looks like a spherical planet. The rest of them kind of look like asteroids. And, you know, our friend, the late Dr. Tom Van Flandern, his theory was that it was actually an escaped moon of Neptune because of some cataclysmic event that happened back in the early days of the solar system. And I think that that model is now really probably turning out to be correct, because neither of them appear to be small icy dwarf planets, but they make a lot of sense as moons, because Pluto really fits into that size category and density category of a lot of the moons of Uranus and Neptune. So, you know, I think we really are in a very exciting time. And you know, the thing is, George, did you ever think we'd ever see anything like this in our lifetime? Because I never did.
Well, you know, how old were you when we landed on the moon? Were you even born?
Yes, I was. I don't want to say how old I was, but I was old enough. Yeah, I was nine. I was 9.
Okay, you were a little boy.
Yeah.
You're a little boy. So, you know, I was 19. So I witnessed it with my dad. Mm-hmm. I loved science, had a telescope. I was into all this, built little rockets. I did it all. I thought, answering your question, that we would have incredible technology one day and do all kinds of things. You know, Mike, when I was a little kid, I built a little camera in the tip of a little rocket, mm-hmm. and it took a picture, one shot, on its way down. And it was a little photograph, and gosh, I'd probably have it stored away in some box somewhere. It took a picture about 300 feet up of me and my friends looking up at it, and it was a little black and white photograph, and right. I'll just never forget it. And I said that day to my friends, I said, the time's going to come, we're going to take incredible pictures in space, and look what we're doing.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I mean, there's a picture that came out from, I don't think it was Galileo. It's a probe around Cassini, the probe around Saturn. And it was a picture of Saturn basically eclipsing the sun. So the sun was behind Saturn. And you saw the rings and some of the moons and the light coming through. And I guess I never really thought we'd see those kinds of things. I mean, maybe it's not that I didn't believe that we'd have advanced technology and things like this would happen. But I don't know. There was part of me that never thought they'd really share it with us, or that it would take so long, because I guess, you know, things slowed down so much after Apollo, and we really stopped developing technology, and it seemed like it took so long. Now we all finally have Captain Kirk's communicators, you know, from Star Trek. We finally have those, but gosh, didn't it take a long time? I mean, it took a really, really long time for that to happen.
It just did.
I don't know. I guess I should have been more, you know, thinking more forward. But, you know, I look at pictures from the 80s and stuff, and I think, you know, what's really the difference between then and now? And the only thing I can really think of, and it's a huge difference, is the internet. You know, that's really the only really major technological advance that we've had, because phones are still phones. You've got, you know, you had primitive computers then. We have more sophisticated computers now. But it seems like we haven't really advanced as much as
I think the smartphones, beyond just cell phones, the smartphones now are incredible, because people, At a moment's notice, they've got their computers in their pockets or in their hands, mm-hmm. and they're able to get any kinds of information. Somebody wants a question about Mike Barra, and they're out. They just go to their smartphone, you know, and
they'll get a whole bunch of BS about me that's not true.
And they get it all.
Yeah, right.
They get it all. So before we get into your book, Ceres, this object in the asteroid belt,
yeah.
which is, they, some call it an asteroid, others call it a dwarf planet. What the heck is it?
It's another moon. It's a moon of a destroyed planet, of which the asteroid belt is the remnants of that planet. I mean, some people have called it over the years, Phaeton is the name that was given to it. And, you know, there were two planets in the solar system that are missing, one about the orbit where Mars is now, and we know that Mars was a moon of that planet, which was destroyed. And there was another planet, this other one, Phaeton, was where the asteroid belt is. So, you know, Bode's Law says there should have been planets there, and there really weren't. And I think Ceres is a moon of that large world that got destroyed in some sort of unimaginable cataclysm that probably had really, really terrible, devastating effects on everybody, on every planet in the solar system. And that's what I think it is. I think it's a moon. There's, you know, again, how do a bunch of asteroids that supposedly collide together and somehow magically glue themselves together rather than break themselves apart, how do they form a sphere? How do they form that shape? And it's like, it doesn't happen that way. These things are, I think, you know, fissioned off from the planets the way, again, Tom originally theorized back in the late 90s. And, you know, Ceres is just fascinating to me because it clearly, I think, used to be part of a different solar system. I think we had all kinds of mini solar systems all over this solar system. You know, we had many, many planets with many moons, and most of them are gone now, but Ceres survives.
They say it was discovered in 1801. Why are we just starting to talk about it now?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I guess that it was not considered all that important, although it was thought at first to be, you know, a missing planet. That's what they were actually looking for.
I mean, I didn't know about it.
Yeah, and they were looking for a planet back in those days between Mars and Jupiter, and they found Ceres, which helped to really perpetuate the discovery of the asteroid belt itself. But it has, I guess it just hasn't been a high priority, although looking at it now, some of the pictures we've seen, I think maybe it should have been a higher priority.
There's a pyramid on that thing, Mike.
Well, there's something, you know, I don't know what that is. By the way, I was going to say, I have a Facebook page, Mike Barra Author, in parentheses, and if you search for that, I've got some pictures up on that page for people that are listening to go look at of some of the things we're talking about tonight, and I'm going to keep posting more. But, you know, if you look at that pyramidal thing, I don't know, George, I don't really think that that's very pyramidal looking. I mean, it's weird to me that NASA called it a pyramid because it looks to me like a fairly common, what they call a cinder cone, which is kind of a conical mountain. Now, it's weird that it's the only one on Ceres.
Yeah, it just pops right up.
Yeah. And that's a little strange because usually they're part of mountain ranges, but maybe one of your, you know, maybe somebody like Stuart could come on and give us a little geologic assessment of it. But I didn't think it was really very pyramidal, and it weirded me out that they made mention of that. And then I thought about, well, why? What are they trying to distract us from besides the bright lights that they found? And, you know, that was the same day, roughly, that the picture of the pyramidal kind of capstone rock, whatever you want to call it, on Mars was released from the Curiosity rover. So I kind of think maybe they wanted us to look at this pyramid that's not a pyramid and not really look at the pyramid on Mars that probably is a pyramid. So that's what I think was going on.
Lots of strange things going out there, Mike.
Yep.
Lots of strange
yep.
things. Ancient aliens and secret societies. Tell me about this. Great,
well,
great title.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it's pretty easy when you put ancient aliens in the title. Come up with something to follow it up with.
It's a winner right there.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I'd done books about the moon, Ancient Aliens on the Moon, and I'd done two books on Mars, Ancient Aliens on Mars, and probably there could be a third book in the Mars series because there's just so much stuff to look at on Mars.
Endless, yeah.
But, you know, I started to think about what did I want to do next, and what really got me was, okay, what, you know, this stuff exists, these civilizations did exist, somebody seems to have known from our distant past that they were there because of other research I'd done for other projects. I knew that somebody knew that this stuff was out there before we ever ventured into space. And those people were primarily members of secret societies like the Scottish Rite Freemasons and the, you know, the real freak show of Aleister Crowley followers that operated out of JPL for a number of years and probably still do. And I started looking at all this and again, looking at all the SS members, all the Nazi members, like Wernher von Braun, who had worked at NASA. And I begin to think, okay, how did this information get from the ancient aliens to the guys who were working at NASA? Because I felt like there was definitely a connection there. And I started to think about how do we connect that thread? And the first thought that I had was that this book was going to be, you know, a lot about the stuff that I'd you know found in NASA about a lot of the participation of the Nazis, the Freemasons, the so-called magicians out there at JPL, and the things that they had done, and all the stellar alignment work that I'd done, and you know the fact that they seemed to always want to land with Orion's belt and 33 degrees above the landing site, those types of things that just kept coming up, and you know I thought I was going to write a book about that, and then as I got into this, it kind of really began to shift for me because I realized there was a lot of other stuff, other holes that were now being filled in. And the main thing was that all this stuff seemed to connect back to the Sitchin stories of the Anunnaki, these guys who came to Earth 400,000 years ago and, according to the legend, you know, made us from them by manipulating our genetics and crossing us with them. So I started going off in that direction. And the more I dug into that, the more it appeared like there was these two different aspects to this. There's the very, very ancient story, and then there's everything that happened after the flood. And so then I started asking questions, well, did a flood really happen? And that started me, like, that was chapter one, was there actually a flood? And, you know, as I dug into that information, more and more, it became more and more obvious to me that there definitely was this flood that took place. And you've had a million guests on that have talked about it, and all the different legends from ancient cultures that have, that have talked about floods and flood myths and arcs and everything. And then I actually found some charts and stuff and put them together. And, you know, there are 35 or 45 different ancient cultures that have these flood myths that connect with an ark and with a higher angel or God telling somebody that there's going to be this huge flood, and you're going to have to build a boat. You're basically going to have to build an ark to survive this thing. So, you know, that got me started on chapter one, and I started then to focus on, okay, what really could have caused a global flood? And, you know, there are really only a couple of answers. And the one that really stuck out was this idea of research of a guy named Randall Carlson, who is a geologist and has basically come to believe that there's something called the Younger Dryas impact event.
That means big freeze.
Yeah, about 12,000 years ago. But at the time, what it would have done is it would have, and again, looking at the pattern, the scatter pattern, he went back and looked at a lot of different evidence, one of the best evidence being these objects called nanodiamonds, which are really, really tiny, minute little diamonds that are formed during high-speed, high-temperature impact events like comets and asteroids.
And heavy compression.
And yeah, and they found these in a pattern basically sweeping across the northern hemisphere into North America. And I think they at least found 22 different sites, all dated to this one period of about 12,000 to 13,000 years ago, right around that time. And so it looks as though some sort of object like a comet came in and broke up and just scattershot it all across Europe and the Atlantic Ocean and North America. And if that had hit the huge polar ice caps that existed at that time with that kind of heat and impact, you know, there's a couple things that could have happened. First of all, stuff would have instantly melted. Massive amounts of ice would have instantly melted, or massive amounts of water would have been, you know, basically steam would have been ejected into the upper atmosphere and then fallen as rain. And as I dug deeper and deeper into it and talked to Randall more and more, you know, I raised the specific question, could it have actually rained for 40 days and 40 nights if something like that had happened? And he said, yeah, absolutely. If the object was big enough and there were enough pieces and they were going fast enough, and these are the limits and they're all well within known, you know, parameters of impact events, and it hit the northern polar cap, which was massive at that time, he said easily it could have rained like that for even longer than 40 days and 40 nights. And that would have basically covered the entire Earth with water. So, you know, I had a plausible scenario, and there's also another theory, which is really, really interesting, that is very popular with the Christian researchers, and that's this idea of a water vapor canopy. The idea that the Earth's atmosphere at one time was a lot thicker, and, you know, they use that to explain, well, why did Methuselah and some of the people in the Bible, the very early patriarchs, why did they live 800, 900 years? And, you know, the theory is that this very, very thick atmosphere basically protected us from a lot of the damaging radiation that damages and breaks down our DNA. And so instead of living only maybe 100 to 120 years, we were living 800, 900, maybe even 1,000 years while we were protected by this. And if an object like a comet or an asteroid went through this canopy and shattered it and broke it up and made it fall to the Earth, it would have fallen to the Earth as rain. And it would have covered the entire planet. And kind of looking at those two scenarios, both of them made a certain amount of sense to me. And, you know, you start to look at the biblical verses, George, and they absolutely fit with that information.
They do. Michael, stay with us. Going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more ancient aliens and secret societies on Coast to Coast AM. If you go to beyondbelief.com and sign up for our television program, you can watch the show that we did with Mike Barra some time ago. It was a great program. You just go to the website, beyondbelief.com, sign up. There's a great promotion going, 99 cents for the first month. Yep, you heard me, 99 cents. Beyondbelief.com. It is simple as that. Welcome back. Mike Barrow with us here on Coast to Coast as we talk about his work, Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies. These secret societies, Mike, are we talking about the Masons and people like that?
Yeah, the Freemasons, the Nazis or the SS, and what I call the magicians who were followers of Aleister Crowley and other practitioners of black magic and stuff. They're the three main ones that I think are significant because they ended up at NASA. Now, you hear about other stuff like, you know, the Illuminati, but the truth is, you know, George, I can't find any evidence that the Illuminati actually existed, whereas I can tell you for a fact, I can quote you chapter and verse, the fact that Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the surface of the moon and the only man on Apollo 11 who was photographed on the surface of the moon, went there, you know, in his personal preference kit, with a Masonic flag, a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Freemason Masonic ceremonial apron that he took to the surface of the moon. And I am 95% sure I can basically prove that he performed a Masonic ceremony in the lunar module before he and Neil Armstrong went out on the surface of the moon.
What kind of ceremony would that be, Mike?
Well, it would be what's normally called a communion ceremony. He's admitted that he did do this, that he basically broke bread and ate it and then poured wine and drank it, which is, again, theoretically a Christian ceremony. But yes, if you dig into the background of it, it actually is a ceremony, an offering to the Egyptian god Osiris, who's represented by the constellation of Orion in the stellar religion of the ancient Egyptians, and is also depicted on all kinds of NASA patches. Like the original Apollo patch actually had Orion on it for some strange reason, and that's got no connection to the Greek Apollo myth. So why it would be Orion on there, it's unless it was connected to the Egyptian, is really hard to figure out. One of the lunar modules was named Orion, and they recently had the Orion program. So NASA kind of has this Osiris obsession. And in fact, Buzz Aldrin went ahead and performed that ceremony, you know, basically 46 years ago, 46 years and 3 days ago, he did that on the surface of the moon. And I can show you that. So when I think of the secret societies, I look at the ones that I know exist that I can actually put my finger on. Some of them, the Illuminati, I can't really put my finger on them because there's really no proof that they exist other than the rumors.
Mike, let's get back to the Ark story a moment and this big freeze event as well. If the Ark story is correct, and we're going to use a little mythology here with you and biblical talk too, where is Noah's Ark? Where is it?
Well, you know, the main place that everybody's always looked or always thought they would find it has been Turkey, because the Bible says that it came to rest in the mountains of Ararat. And that is known to be around what they consider to be, you know, Mount Ararat. The problem is that it was Marco Polo, I think in the 1300s, who actually gave Mount Ararat its name. But there are lots of there's other areas around there, very mountainous next to Ararat, that are actually also called Ararat or variations of that name.
It's brutal terrain, isn't it?
It is very brutal. It is very high, and so there, you know, that's where people have focused their attention. And the thing is, look, if there was an advanced civilization, an Atlantean civilization, and it was probably connected to the Anunnaki, such as Anunnaki, and they did survive, or they taught some humans, Enki anyway. The big thing that the story is that the story goes that Enlil, who was the ruler of the earth, didn't like mankind very much and was willing to let us be wiped out by the flood. But Enki, who was the creator, one of the creators of the human race, really loved us and wanted to save us. So that's why the God in the biblical version, who was, you know, has to be one God, not two, kind of is of two minds. On the one hand, he wants to destroy mankind. On the other hand, he decides to tell Noah to build an ark and save mankind. So, the fact is that if there was a great flood, and there appears to be very solid evidence that there was, then logically there would be an ark. So why don't we go look and dig into the ark? That was my next question. And you know, I found out there's quite a bit of background stuff on the Ark and on people that have searched for it over the years, and there's a lot of interesting stories. And turns out that there's two, I think, pretty good candidates that could both be the ruins, the wreckage of the Ark.
Now, of course, I find it hard to believe, Mike, that he was able to take every animal in pairs on an Ark.
Right.
What if he took DNA, however?
Yeah, that's what I think exactly, because actually some of the old writings from the various cultures say not just that he took animals 2 by 2, but he took the seeds, not just the seeds of the earth like the plants, but the seeds 2 by 2. And that means, could mean, the seeds of the animals, which is also just genetic sampling, DNA. And, you know, again, if you look at the, you look at the stuff that Sitchin translated, you know, if the Anunnaki were nothing if not master genetic manipulators, and there's no reason why they couldn't have cataloged a lot of the flora and fauna and the animals and so forth that were here on Earth. And in fact, also, you know, George, if you look at the history of a lot of these animal species, some of them didn't exist until around the time of the flood,
That's
if the
right.
flood was 12,000 years ago. So it's possible some of them were cobbled together after this whole thing happened, and they were, you know, society and culture and civilization was being rebuilt. So, as I dug into this, what I found is that there was this, of course, this object called the Ararat Anomaly, which was photographed in a 1947 reconnaissance flight, photograph on Mount Ararat itself, very, very high up, about 11,000 feet. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is that there are stories of people who went and claimed that they saw the Ark in the early 1900s. George Hagopian was one of the people who claimed that as a little boy in like 1904 or 1905, he actually climbed up on the Ark. And
what happened to it?
Well, his dad shot at it, by the way. Yeah, so that's
oh,
the,
nice.
I'm like, oh, here's Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
Let's shoot at
yeah.
it.
Yeah, same with Bigfoot.
Yeah, he said it was fossilized and stone-like. But, you know, he claimed that they were able to get up to this certain level that is not normally accessible because it was such a hot summer and so much of the ice had melted. And he described it very specifically and made paintings of it. And then later on, another in the 1930s, I believe, another researcher or farmer was walking up there in the area, and he claimed to have come upon the same wreckage, only now it had been cleaved into two halves. It had been broken into two parts, and they were separated. And when you look at this Ararat Anomaly images, if you look at the images, what you see is that it looks like the Ark is in two pieces. It's broken in half, and the ice has kind of come back in. And like the ice, when it grew back and rebuilt, it sort of split this wooden structure or stone structure by now, because it was fossilized, in half. So that those stories are really interesting. You know, and what's fascinating is that the paintings that were made based on the recollections of these two different guys were extremely similar, even, and the terrain was extremely similar, even though they really didn't know of each other's stories when they were first put together. So I thought that was really pretty interesting. But then there came up information on another site called the Darunapar site, because it was found again by, I think, a Turkish aerial reconnaissance pilot named, I forget his first name, but his last name was Darunapar, and he saw a boat-like outline in
we've seen that picture, I think.
Yeah, and you know, and then this there were some expeditions there, and there were people who said, well, we didn't really find anything, we didn't find any wood. Well, you know, after 10 or 12,000 years, the wood is going to become fossilized. It's going to basically take on the texture and the you know, the properties of the rock around it. And there have since been some other people that have gone there. There's a guy named David Fassold, who was very, very interested in this area, and he brought ground-penetrating radar, among other things. And what he found, and this is one of the images that's up on the Facebook page, is you know, basically when he used this ground-penetrating radar, he found that there were right-angular cross-supporting beams buried under the mud and the dirt. And basically what you're looking at is a couple of keel beams and some cross beams and all of this stuff, plus the fact that they found rivets there, they found metal rivets, they found all kinds of other features like supports on the side, outside supports that appeared to be structural and curved like you would on the outside of a boat, and the fact that it is exactly 500 Egyptian cubits long, which is exactly the length given in the Bible for the Ark, makes it, to me, pretty convincing that I think that might be the site. That's at about 6,500 feet. That might actually be the site where the Ark did come to rest, and this thing might actually be the Ark of Noah. So,
what a great discovery if that happens.
Yeah, and, you know, again, it's debatable, it's up for debate, but there's a lot of study that's been done, and, you know, I'm convinced that one of those two sites is probably really the Ark.
Many of us all know the theories of the late Zechariah Sitchin, Mike, of which he believes that there was a planet in our solar system called Nibiru, 3,600-year elliptical orbit, and that the inhabitants of that planet, the Anunnaki, came here to mine for gold, then genetically manipulated the creatures that were on this planet, and hence here we are. You have a different twist to this.
Well, I think that some of the things that have been said about the Anunnaki that Sitchin wrote early in his career are not the same as the things he wrote later. And people don't seem to pay as much attention to his later books, but they should, because this, you know, was far deeper into his research path, and he understood things better. For instance, it's often said that we were created as a slave race. Well, no, we weren't. And apparently, according to Sitchin, there were actually very long moral debates about whether we should be created at all, because we would not be creatures, we would be beings, as they described. In other words, conscious beings with souls, and they didn't think that that was on the same level as creatures, so they didn't treat us that way. So that's kind of a misreported aspect of his research. But, as I got into this, I started watching, like I watched the film Noah
I hated that movie.
Yeah, well, it was really bizarre, but it was
you probably Russell watched, Crow. Knowing you, you watched it with Russell Crowe.
Yeah, Russell Crowe, yeah, thank you. Russell Crowe and Jennifer Connelly, whose name I would never forget. But I watched the movie, and it was really fascinating. It was weird to me, because there was the sky was different, and things were different on the Earth, and there were these guys called the Watchers. And I started asking myself, who are the Watchers? They're mentioned in the Bible a few times. They're called angels. Yeah. There were something like 200 of them, and in the film, they are basically neither divine angelic beings nor are they fully beings of the earth.
They were rocks, weren't
they?
Right,
but because they have that aspect, that earthly aspect, they were bound to the earth, it said. And and then I started reading, Sitchin's book, The Lost Book of Enki, mm-hmm. which is advertised as historical fiction.
Was that his last book?
It was very close to his last book. Yeah, I think it was 2010. It's called historical fiction, but the truth is I have a friend who knew Sitchin extremely well. And I talked to him about it, and I said, look, what can you tell me about this book? And what he told me, and I probably shouldn't say this on the air, but I'm going to say it anyway, is that at the end, Sitchin was not getting his information from the clay tablets and cylinder seals, but that he was getting it directly from the Anunnaki themselves.
Oh, really?
And that story in there is not fiction at all, that it was actually supposedly, quote, according to Sitchin, he says... Sitchin
almost like they wrote it through him, or he wrote it through them.
That Enki dictated this, because it's basically Enki's story of the things that happened.
Wow.
These things that happened, and the way things really happened from 400,000 years ago to today. And then I thought, well, I'd better read this as part of my research. And I got into it, and, I found, the story, George, is absolutely tragic, really.
Tragic and fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating, tragic. But it's like they had the same human foibles that we had, even though they might have had advanced technology.
Maybe more.
Yeah, and there were all sorts of things. Girls get involved, and the men cross marrying and everything, and the rivalry between Enki and Enlil over who was going to run the planet was very intense, because Enki was actually born first, but according to the legal laws of succession, he was born to a concubine, not to a legal spouse, whereas Enlil came along later, and there was a big fight between who was the wiser and who was the one who really should run the planet. But Enki was the scientist, and he helped create the Adamu, the very first man. And there's other things. People look at some of these images of and think of them as giants, and the Anunnaki as giants. And I'm not convinced that they were. I don't think they were really very much different from us in terms of their physical stature, because you look at some of these images where Ninhursag or Ninma, as she's called, is holding the Adamu, and they're saying, oh, well, look at how much bigger she is. And I was like, that's because he's a baby, There's this missing aspect to it. So, because then also they couldn't have interbred with human females. And if they were some gigantic size, mm-hmm. they just simply wouldn't have been able to physically put it together. So what got me really going on this and really starting to look at this in a whole new way was the fact that what that meant to me was that their intentions were not to enslave us, to treat us as less than them. They did try to limit us to a certain extent, because they didn't want us to make the same mistakes that they had made.
Or revolt.
Right. Or revolt. And it turns out that there were 200 guys working on Mars, the exact same number of the watchers in the Bible. And just like the watchers in the Bible, they came to Earth for some R&R, and they complained about their situation, that there were no women there. Mars is a Mars needs women, apparently. It was a lonely place, and they needed women, and they were unhappy with their circumstances, and they didn't get good enough answers from Enlil. And what they did was that they picked they picked wives for themselves, and they kidnapped them and stole them away and did revolt. And they were called the Ijiji. So the Watchers and the Ijiji seem to be the same thing. And it's just fascinating to read these stories. And the name of their commander was Satanal, S-A-T-A-N-A-I-L, Satanal or Satanal. So, gee, where do we get the name Satan from? As you start to put all these things together, it becomes really obvious to me that all this ancient stuff, all these stories, are probably a lot different than we think, and even different maybe than Sitchin interpreted them originally, because he changed a bunch of information as he started writing this historical novel. And I'm like, well, why would he do that? Why wouldn't he be consistent with what he wrote unless he was corrected by some new source? And, it also kind of really aligned with information I got from Bob Dean, who has done, read the official book. And he said it very publicly, extraterrestrials are not working with the government. They are the government, that there are Anunnaki still here on this planet.
So they never left.
They never left. They tried. A lot of them left. Most of them left because it's like the moment in The Lord of the Rings where one of the elves says, it's the time of man now and we need to leave and let men run things. And it was the same analogy that was made, that I think at the end of their big battle that Enki and Enlil, kind of agreed that they needed to go away and let us have our own path. But I don't think they really left. And I've been, again, told directly by a source who knew him very well that that book was dictated to him by Enki, who is still here. And if their lifespans were as long as Sitchin thought they were, that's not impossible. He could certainly have lived another 5, 6, 7, 8,000 years right into today. And he wouldn't be a whole lot older than he was back then, back in, about 5,000 BC, when I think they all packed up and pretty much went away. And, you had, I think, some Anunnaki who probably stayed behind here because they would rather be kings on Earth and be worshipped as gods than be, workers.
Sure.
Back on Nibiru. And I think the last of that line of guys was probably Goliath, who was, slain by David. And I'm sure he was a big guy. Maybe he was 6 or 7 feet tall, but
maybe eight.
Yeah.
Eight bricker.
And David, David killed him and sort of established our own kingly line. And so all these things begin to come together, and they all begin to focus on one guy who stayed behind and stayed in charge. And that guy's name is Marduk. And he was a son of Enki, and he is the guy for whom Cairo is named. Cairo is an Arabic word meaning Mars. The planet Mars was changed to that name because of him, and he was there for a while running things, and he's the one, I think, who started the secret society.
We're going to come back, talk more with Mike Barra about ancient aliens and secret societies, and of course, it's the last hour. That means we'll take your phone calls as well.